And we're up and running. Okay, Cool Edit is being cool now. Again, for the sake of the recording program, this is the Mideast Madness Show with your host, Ren, for July 1st, 2013. The Monday show. It's 3:06 p.m. Now what, you may ask? Yes, Free Radio did have its really wonderful fundraising concert back on June 15th, celebrating my 60th year of life. Well, okay, that's a coincidence. Also happened to be the big June 15th, 2012 fundraising party for Free Radio Santa Cruz. We made some $400. Would have been lovely to see a lot more people there. And I'm pulling up my website so I have something to read to y'all. By the way, any of you out there ever heard of PRT? It's an acronym for Personal Rapid Transit. It is a technology, a form of public transit, and in my way of looking at it, rapid transit, which consists of pod cars in which up to three or four adults can fit, and the pod car rides atop an elevated guideway. This is a technology which is currently in use at Heathrow Airport in London, Great Britain. London, England, Great Britain. And there's a group of us here in Santa Cruz, California, which is trying to get it up and running. Santa Cruz's very own PRT system. A technology, by the way, which was introduced to the world and developed extensively by one Professor John Edward Anderson, retired, University of Minnesota. I lived in Minnesota for a very long time. Where, as you can imagine, I became aware of the technology and became a public advocate for it there. Now I live here in Santa Cruz, in California again, where I was born and bred myself. And I've hooked up with the PRT community here. And if you're interested in finding out more, possibly becoming involved with that effort, you can go to, well, I'm not absolutely sure the website, but if you just Google Santa Cruz PRT or PRT, that's for Personal Rapid Transit, PRT Santa Cruz, Google that, do a search on that, and you'll get the website for the Santa Cruz effort. Okay. This is the Mideast Madness Show. And let's start with something positive. And, security warning. I think we're good. Yeah, something positive and light about Palestinian children. Says here, trip for 50 kids from Balata refugee camp to visit the beach for the first time in Haifa. Haifa is a city in modern-day Israel, which, incidentally, is one of the two locations where my late father and his late-late brother, working as business partners, had a couple of hardware businesses, one located in Haifa, the northern part of present-day Israel on the coast, and the other store in Jerusalem, which they lost upon the invention of 20th century Israel. They lost all that wealth, and my uncle lost his life at the point of a gun. At any rate, that is another story. Trip for 50 kids from Balata refugee camp to visit the beach for the first time in Haifa. Short teaser. There is a picture, a photograph on the infamous so-called security wall that Israel has erected between itself and its illegal Jewish settlements located in Palestine, the wall that separates them and the occupied territories, which we like to think of as free Palestine, but of course it's not free because it is militarily occupied by Israel. There is a picture of one section of the wall and a drawing of a child displaying the two-fingered peace sign and wearing a keffiyeh or a hatta or hedda, depending on your dialect and language, I guess. You see those pictures all the time. They were so scary to we Westerners to see pictures of hooded, hidden faces with maybe only the eyes poking out under a keffiyeh. But this is clearly a child wearing it. And it says next to the child, Free Palestine. Bus stop hip-hop tour. What's this about? Peace and love. This, by the way, is Nancy talking. Nancy is co-founder of Existence is Resistance. Existence is Resistance. www.existenceisresistance.org. Peace and love. Since I arrived in Palestine, I have been meaning to write about everything and post it, but since it's the first time I am here in 5 years not organizing a tour and have been catching up with family, it's been hectic. Of course, I visited the Afa Cultural Center located in Balata refugee camp in Nablus, which is Palestine's largest refugee camp in the West Bank, way up in the north there, which our organization, Existence is Resistance, works closely with each year and always accommodates our tours in their guest house at no charge whatsoever. I caught up with the beautiful children I have seen grow over the years and become attached to. They asked me about the past artists and youth we have brought here. We drew together and sang together, and then they asked me what the sea is like in Haifa. Do I swim? Do I get hit by the waves? They asked me to describe it. It breaks my heart when they tell me they have never seen the sea and that they have never visited where many of their grandparents were forced out of. So I took it upon myself, with the help of some family members and a youth center in Haifa, to apply for 53 permits for 50 children from Balata to come to Haifa for one day, thinking at least 20 will be refused because of family members in jail or whatever other crappy, sorry-ass excuses Israel uses against little children to refuse them entering 48 territories. I received a phone call yesterday, and to my surprise, 50 children were approved. 50 children were approved permits, with many exclamation points. Yes, I cried. Again, this is Nancy, co-founder of Existence is Resistance, the little dispatch she sent out about this incident. Continuing. We have received spaces and a theater to use while they are there. However, we need to raise money just for the buses, which will pick them up from the refugee, pick them up from the refugee camp and take them to Haifa and bring them back to the camp that night, as well as food for them for the day. The total we need to raise is $3,620, and we don't have much time. If any of you would be kind enough to please, please help out, no matter how much it is, we would so appreciate this, and it will bring joy to the kids. Please, please email EIR It's eir.nyc@gmail.com for information. Please put Balata outing to Haifa. Balata is spelled B as in boy, A-L-A-T-A. Balata outing to Haifa, H-A-I-F-A. In the subject line. On how and where to donate. If you want to pay the bus company directly for the bus or the food, places directly by card, please indicate that, and we can push you in touch with them directly. It's a weird sentence. Let me read it again. If you want to pay the bus company directly for the bus or the food directly by card, please indicate that, and we can put you in touch with them directly. Please help us make a difference. Love and peace, Nancy. This was forwarded to me from my lovely friend Donna, who also happens to be a programmer with her own show here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. She loves to pass on stuff like this, and she has a lot of contacts, meaningful contacts. Okay. For the children of Balata Refugee Camp, 50 of them, what can we do? People have been talking a lot about Nelson Mandela lately. He does not appear to have much longer to live in his present form. Some of you may have interpreted that sound correctly. I just imbibed upon a lovely beverage to wet my whistle. Muzzle Watch is one of the services of Jewish Voice for Peace. Jewish Voice for Peace, a pro-justice, pro-peace, and as pro-Palestinian as it is pro-Israeli organization, maintains a famous web service, JVP, Jewish Voice for Peace, and Muzzle Watch is one of the features they offer. I have a subscription to Muzzle Watch. This came out, I have an address here, June 27, so around the 27th of June, 3 days ago, Marilyn Nymark and Donna Neville wrote the following, entitled In Honor of Nelson Mandela. JVP, again, Jewish Voice for Peace, joins with people and communities across the globe in expressing our admiration, love, and gratitude for Nelson Mandela, a giant in the struggle for justice and an inspiration to us all. Had Muzzle Watch existed 23 years ago when Mandela, newly released from prison, made a thrilling visit to New York, the shameful response of the, quote, official, end quote, Jewish community would have been the lead story here for days, had Muzzle Watch existed 23 years ago. While 750,000 New Yorkers of all sorts poured into the streets to cheer this courageous hero, the Jewish establishment sat out the festivities. Why? Muzzle Watch readers need no hints. Whoopsie. This world leader who sat in jail for 27 years for fighting apartheid was not an acceptable Zionist. His visit coincided with the moment we were co-founding the New York-based organization Jews for Racial and Economic Justice, JFREJ, and we were disgusted that the Jewish establishment announced that they were withholding their welcome of him to our city unless he satisfies them on his support for Israel. It was a stark demonstration of the way right-leaning Israeli politics were skewing Jewish participation in progressive causes here, which is part of why we formed Jews for Racial and Economic Justice. We decided that our inaugural event should be a symbolic welcome of Mandela from the substantial wing of the Jewish community that was happy and grateful to embrace him. More than 1,000 people from across the city attended the Shabbat service in celebration of his achievement. Among the speakers, Harry Belafonte, Henry Schwarzschild, Grace Paley, and the African National Congress representative Susan Numzama, with a closing song by Bernice Johnson Reagan. The service was led by rabbis Marshall Meyer, Rolando Matalon, and Balfour Brickner. We raised $30,000 to present to the ANC, African National Congress, that evening, along with a statement applauding Mandela, and I quote, as a moral voice for peace, justice, and self-determination for all peoples. We managed to get the word out in other ways, too. JFREJ founding board member Alyssa Solomon landed an op-ed in the New York Times, despite the New York Times editor's cautious hands, what was a radical critique in the mainstream media at the time could today have been penned by J Street. Oh, that's a weird sentence. I'll read it again. The whole paragraph there. We managed to get word out in other ways, too. Jews for Racial and Economic Justice founding board member Alyssa Solomon landed an opinion editorial, an op-ed in the New York Times, and then it says parenthetically, despite the NYT editor's cautious hands, what was a radical critique in the mainstream media at that time could today have been penned by J Street. J Street is another pro-peace, pro-two-state solution organization, although J Street is also Zionist. Every time I hear the term J Street and have something to say about J Street, I'm always inclined to express my hesitancy in welcoming them to the discussion with fully open arms, because I think there is a somewhat alluded to schizophrenic quality of a Zionist organization being pro two state, but I will take them at the word. Finally, these writers of this in honor of Nelson Mandela, Marilyn Nymark and Donna Neville, they end their piece with, we share her text and the rousing remarks of Harry Belafonte here. Okay. So here is Alyssa Solomon's New York Times op-ed. I hope it comes up. All computers seem to be very slow today. My personal computer at home is just crawling, and this one is not much better, if better at all. Okay, here's the op-ed from NYT, and again, I'm looking for a date. This is, New York Times, Friday, June 8th, 1990. 23 years ago when Nelson Mandela visited New York City, June 8, 1990. Don't Test Mandela on Israel by Alyssa Solomon. Nelson Mandela is on his way to Geneva, Switzerland, to meet with leaders of half a dozen mainstream American Jewish organizations who are asking him to clarify his position on Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization. Mr. Mandela's answers will determine not only how, but whether several major Jewish organizations, such as the American Jewish Congress and the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, welcome Mr. Mandela to New York City on June 20th. Will Mr. Mandela utter the magic words these men want to hear? What troubles many Jewish leaders is what they call Mr. Mandela's embrace of Yasser Arafat. Yasser Arafat, the late Yasser Arafat, was longtime chairman of the PLO, Palestine Liberation Organization. Mr. Mandela has met with Mr. Arafat twice and has expressed his sympathy with the PLO's cause for self-determination for the Palestinian people. Spokespersons for Jewish organizations have told me that if Mr. Mandela says in Geneva that there is no question that Israel exists, that won't be enough. Again, that won't be enough for Mandela to say that Israel exists. If he says that Israel should live with guaranteed security beside a Palestinian state, that won't be enough either. Only the magic phrase, Israel has a right to exist, will do. Even then, he better not add a word more. If his response is, if his response is inadequate, Mr. Mandela will be greeted by a variety of protests on his visit. The Jewish community's decision to stand up for a cause of such clear moral rectitude as the fight to end apartheid should not be held hostage to this litmus test. With a sly trick of the trope, Mr. Mandela's physical greeting of Mr. Arafat, clasping shoulders, is employed for metaphorical duty. Saying that he has, quote, embraced Mr. Arafat is meant to imply that he adopts everything Mr. Arafat has ever said or done. Mr. Mandela has done no such thing. Again, I am reading from an opinion editorial which appeared in the New York Times on June the 8th, 1990, preceding a visit of Nelson Mandela to New York City. Continuing with op-ed. He has, as has the African National Congress, supported the call for Palestinian rights. So have countless American Jews. So have countless Israelis. Indeed, members of the Knesset and Israeli military officers have long argued that Israel's security depends on Palestinian self-determination in the West Bank and Gaza. This was written 23 years ago, folks. Obviously, there is no majority position on this matter in Israel, but it is openly debated. Only among America's mainstream Jewish leadership is discussion denied. As a result, the mainstream Jewish leaders misrepresent the people for whom they claim to speak. Opinion polls show that the majority of American Jews support a land for peace compromise between Israel and Palestinians in the occupied territories. As a poll funded by the Israeli Diaspora Institute and Israeli Policy Center has revealed that the leaders don't even speak their own minds. A full 76% of leaders of American Jewish groups back trading land on the West Bank and Gaza for peace. Just cooling my throat here a little more. Back to the op-ed. Clearly, then, American Jews and their purported leaders have no trouble recognizing that supporting Palestinian rights and supporting Israel's existence are not mutually exclusive. Then why assume that because Mr. Mandela speaks out for Palestinians, he is attacking Israel's existence, especially since the ANC has never questioned Israel's status? Many mainstream Jewish leaders object to Mr. Mandela calling Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, quote, a unique form of colonialism. Even if one disagrees, it's understandable that the leader of a Third World Liberation Movement would use such terms to describe a situation in which 1.5 million people live under military occupation without the right to vote. What's more, Mr. Mandela has good reason to be wary of Israel, which continues to sell arms to South Africa. Of course, this being the South Africa of the apartheid South Africa of 1990. Israel, which continues to sell arms to the apartheid government of South Africa. While it's true that Israel need not be singled out for special criticism, plenty of other countries trade with South Africa. Israel must not be excused either. There are Jews and Jewish organizations that will honor Mr. Mandela. Rabbis will participate in interfaith services, and Jews for racial and economic justice will hold a Sabbath service. Yet Jewish right-wing fringe groups threaten to dog Mr. Mandela as he races from event to event, protesting his, quote, communist platform. But mainstream Jewish organizations claim to speak for the Jewish community at large. They are the ones to whom journalists go for quotes. They have the resources to take out ads proclaiming their views. As such, they should be counted among those welcoming Mr. Mandela, a moral voice for human rights all over the world, and author of this op-ed. Alyssa Solomon is a member of Jews for Racial and Economic Justice, a group of religious leaders, professionals, and community organizers. So, some people may hear, although they probably never will, what I've just been reading over the past 5 minutes. And say, oh yeah, New York Times, what do you expect from a commie liberal publication like the New York Times? Well, you're entitled to your opinion. You might want to keep your facts straight, though. It may be difficult for some of us to keep in mind the significances of a number of points of this op-ed, being that it was written 23 years ago. It mentions the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. Of course, this was before Gaza was vacated in 2005 by the Israeli settlers. Although, to this very day in 2013, July of 2013, its borders are sealed from the Israeli side of the border by military units, which severely restrict passage both in and out of individual Gazan Palestinians, goods and services. Israel uses as its alibi for doing this that they want to make sure nothing gets in the Gaza Strip that can be useful in the production or the deployment of missiles against Israel. Except they go too far in preventing repair hardware for infrastructure, such as standard urban infrastructure, parts for machines, including dialysis machines in the hospitals where I visited back in 08. There were only 3 working dialysis machines in Shifa Hospital, where I was given a tour, I and 43 other activists. Infrastructure, as in the treatment plants for water and sewage. Therefore, water flows into the Mediterranean Sea, in which children swim daily. And it's very dirty water. The kids have been known to actually, literally, astounding as this may sound, come out of the water with sores already on their skin as they emerge from the poisoned beaches of Gaza's Mediterranean coast. It's astounding. Supposedly Gaza is free. The Palestinians, according to the Israelis, should be able to create their own economy and create their own wealth and act without the hindrance of those former Jewish settlements, which were illegal to begin with. But Israel will not permit such an economy to take fruition. And in Solomon's op-ed, she talks about, or was it in the article? She says down here, it's understandable that the leader of a third world liberation movement would use such terms to describe a situation in which 1.5 million people live under military occupation without the right to vote. Back in 1990, the total number of Palestinians living under occupation in both the West Bank and the Gaza Strip was 1.5 million people. Today, in the Gaza Strip alone, which is the most densely populated, human-populated entity on the planet, which is effectively, as I described, an open-air prison, in Gaza alone there is now well over 1.5 million people. That doesn't include any of the Palestinians living in the West Bank. There are roughly as many Palestinians, 2 or 3 million of them in the West Bank, compared to 1.6 or 1.7 in the Gaza Strip. Okay. Let us... Now the thing's working. I'll go ahead and read Belafonte's remarks on Mandela's, hear what he had to say. Harry Belafonte was a famous, if of relatively minor stature, American singer, African-American, although I believe he was from the Caribbean. He sang songs emanating from reminiscent of the Caribbean world, West Indies. By the way, it's 3:40 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. This is the Mideast Madness show on Free Radio Santa Cruz, currently off the airwaves, but as ever, streaming live on freakradio.org. Remember, folks, those of you who are listening to me now or on a refeed of this show, since you're on the internet and you're lucky enough to know where to find us, when you share with your friends the fact that we are indeed still maintaining free radio service and that Mideast Madness is still going strong, tell your friends to go to the freakradio.org website, scroll down the page. There is the cartoon image of a radio transmission tower. On top of that tower is big red oval. A red oval. That's a circle that's slightly squished. Tell your friends to click on that red oval, because the other link that gives you the impression that you're supposed to click there doesn't work. So don't click on the thing that says listen. You can only click on the red oval. Turn up their speakers and, you know, go through Real Player, Windows Media Center, whatever program they use to pull in internet radio service. Okay. Harry Belafonte's remarks about Nelson Mandela. Harry Belafonte appeared at the JFREJ Shabbat service welcoming Nelson Mandela to New York City in 1990. Harry Belafonte, co-chair of the Nelson Mandela New York Welcoming Committee. Harry says, I am here this evening because we are all in need of one another. We are more in need of one another, I think, than we have ever been in need of one another before. And in that spirit, you have opened up your holiest of places and have extended the invitation for us to come and to speak and to understand and to be supportive of our community. Keeping in mind, Mr. Belafonte is speaking at a Shabbat service, which is, of course, a Jewish weekly Sabbath service. Belafonte continues, Nelson Mandela, in the 27 and a half years he spent in prison, had a lot of time to think. When he came out of prison, lots of what he had thought about began to express itself to those who could view him, many for the first time in their lives. He brought to his to his own community and to the world a sense of hope, a sense of love, a sense of redemption, and a sense of commonality. He has never once spoken a harsh word since he has walked out of that prison. The many to whom I have spoken, who shared with him the years he was in prison, never heard him speak a hard word then. This spirit that brings an opportunity to come together will be visited to this country next week, Wednesday. I cannot think of a journey that I have ever traveled in the search for human rights, in the search for human dignity, in the search for justice, where there was not a Jewish presence. I have never been in the quest for freedom of black people in this country or for black people in other countries. I have never been in the pursuit of justice for the peoples of Latin America and Asia, and never somewhere, and not find a Jewish presence. I, too, walked from Selma to Montgomery. In that march, there was a Jewish presence. In Mississippi, two young men who were Jews gave their lives for our cause. When history speaks the full and detailed text of the history of Martin Luther King, it will tell you that one of the most trusted people in his life was a Jew by the name of Sam Levinson. And it is in that spirit that when I look at the anti-Semitism that runs rampant in the world, all throughout Europe, new forms of it in Asia, throughout places in Latin America, and here in our own United States, I feel the desperate need for us to come together. When I look at the racism that is rampant against people of color throughout Europe, throughout parts of Asia, and here in the United States, I know it is time to come together, and I know that there is no greater alliance than when Jews and blacks stand together. We have never, ever stepped away from the confrontation with tyranny and oppression where we have not been victorious. The black people of this country are in a desperate state. Their state of desperation is not by choice. I know no one who is poor by choice. I know no one who is ignorant by choice. There are moments within our lives as black people in this country and in this city where we wonder what has happened to our cause. Did it die when the bullet snuffed out the life of Martin Luther King? Instead of moving into a world that is healed by that passing, we are living in circumstances that are in many ways more desperate than before. And when the word arrived that Nelson Mandela was coming to this country, millions of people in this country who have not yet settled the score of racism, millions of people who live excluded from the political system, saw once again the chance of hope and expression for their grievance, because Nelson Mandela, who shares the same struggle, comes to them almost as a Messiah. When, sitting in the organization of his presence here and working on the details of his visit in all eight cities, and the 11 days he will be here, when speaking to the security forces, the secret police from the State Department, I was told that there was a deep concern for his safety, and they rattled off a number of reasons why they held that concern. And one in particular stood out for me when they said, there are segments of the Jewish community that find his presence in this country unwelcome, and they will make their feelings heard. And we are concerned about that because one group in particular has been noted for its willingness to do violence, end quote. That struck me very, very deeply. And I said, the Constitution of our country gives us the right to express our feelings, to protest. As a matter of fact, one of its noblest reasons for existing, the Constitution, is to give room for the dissenter to be heard. So that should not be taken away. But I am concerned that in a time when racism is rampant, in a time when anti-Semitism is rampant, these two groups in particular must not be split apart any further and be put upon in a way that would rip us apart, in a way that would not be healed in this century. And I then thought about it, discussed it with my colleagues, and I reached out to my Jewish brothers and I told them what I had heard. And I told them what I had felt. And I begged their intervention, because without another voice, without another presence, if there was only one side of the Jewish community to be heard from, our nation could very easily be ripped apart. Long after Nelson Mandela has left, we will be left with each other. And in that request that was extended, my Jewish brothers asked many questions of me. And I said to them, I'm not the one that you should be hearing. What you need to hear in order to be able to express to that community unequivocally, I suggest that you speak among yourselves, and if you find it propitious, please go and meet with Nelson Mandela with no intervention, with none of us in your group, with no one to counsel you, with no one to give you shadings. Go among your own and sit with Nelson Mandela and hear what he has to say. Do not have it interpreted to you. Do not listen to rumor. Do not read a text that comes from somewhere else and derive a conclusion. Go yourselves. And when you come back, you will then have the opportunity to join the ranks of the protesters because you believe his presence has no place in our America. Lost my place here, sorry. Mr. Listeners, go yourselves. And when you come back, you will then have the opportunity to join the ranks of the protesters because you believe his presence has no place in our America, or you can join the ranks of those that Nelson Mandela speaks for the peoples of this globe who are facing oppression, facing racism, facing anti-Semitism, and know that we must come together. Let me remind you, these are the words of Harry Belafonte in 1990 at the Jews for Racial Equality and Justice Shabbat service, welcoming Nelson Mandela to New York City. That was no risk for me, Belafonte says. I knew that a healing was on the way. But I'm eternally grateful to you and to your five other representatives who went to Geneva and met with Nelson Mandela because you helped to put America on course. Because what you have achieved is not just the possibility to welcome Nelson Mandela to this country with an embrace that will be one of the largest he will ever have received anywhere, but you will also have helped to set in motion the opportunity for after he is gone for us to continue to move in that spirit, to talk daily, and to bring the blacks and the Jews of this country together and through our commonality to reach out to the Native Americans, to reach out to the Puerto Ricanos, most likely talking about the Puerto Ricans, I think, to reach out to the homeless, to reach out to those who suffer with AIDS, to reach out to all who are in need of our power, our brotherhood, our humanity. Because above and beyond everything else, that is our moral center. And if we betray that, we have betrayed truth, we have betrayed the Judaic ethic. We have betrayed our Christian responsibility, and we have betrayed each other. And we will all perish together. I know, folks, pretty long introductory remarks. We're ending it up here pretty soon, I think. So I thank you. My wife thanks you. We are welcome in your house that is holy to let us begin. And you will hear from our mayor. You will hear from our congressman, Mr. Charles Rangel, and his beloved wife, and from our chancellor of the Bronx Community College, Mr. Roscoe Brown. We are here because you have sent out the word that we are welcomed in your holy place to begin to bring harmony. That's why we are here, and we welcome you into our places of worship. We welcome you into our homes, and let us not ever, ever forget that our humanity and our destiny are inextricably bound, and that if we, in particular the black people and the Jews of this country, turn on one another, I believe there will be no hope for the universe. That's rather a grandiose description of the scope of the impending problem. And admittedly, a speech which is quite hyperbolic, but I won't hold it against Mr. Belafonte, who is most famously an artist and an actor, a singer, but who has indeed been called upon by many champions of racial equality and harmony not just this one, not just Nelson Mandela's visit to NYC, but Mr. Belafonte has over the years had a lot to say about progressive issues involved with racial harmony. So good. Let me give you the phone number since we are live here in the studio, same equipment, same old microphone, same slightly slow computer today. And being a live show of July 1st, 2013 at 3:57 p.m., 1557 hours Pacific Daylight Time. Here are the phone numbers. Area code 831. Line 1 is 427-3772. Again, that's 427-3772. And line 2 on this busy, busy switchboard, as you can hear, 469-3119. 469-3119. Give us a call. Let your voice be heard around the world, potentially, anyway, on the internet, on the World Wide Web. And as long as we're taking somewhat of a break here, let me remind you, if you don't already know so, you've probably guessed that Free Radio Santa Cruz depends most heartily upon your donations. We do not receive any corporate donations for two major reasons. One, no corporation is going to donate to Free Radio, given the kinds of issues we discuss and the way we discuss them. And secondly, and most fundamentally, our Free Radio Santa Cruz's bylaws prohibit us from taking corporate donations and other certain huge dollop donations from certain parties. We depend on your monies sent through the snail mail. Please send whatever you can to FRSC, P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California, zip code 95061. I'll give it to you again, right on the envelope there with your check or money order. Probably should not send cash, but I don't want to discourage people from sending what they can in whatever form. Right on the envelope, FRSC, P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz, two words, and Cruz is spelled C-R-U-Z, Ka, 95061. One more thing, one more side note. In addition to the phone numbers which I've given to you, if you want to communicate anything to me in the name of this radio program, Mideast Madness, send your emails to MideastMadness@gmx.com. Again, all one word, Mideast Madness. At G as in golly, M as in Machiavellian, X as in xenophobe, .com. And I just had a couple of things to say here about JVP's muzzle watch that we started with in this article in honor of Nelson Mandela. The beginning of this article talks about Mandela when he was in jail 23 years ago and for a period of some 27 and a half years in jail. I remember taking a peek into some rag like the National Review or some other super right, ultra right wing rag magazine. where they were talking about what a creep Nelson Mandela was. It's just as well that he was in jail because he was a murderer, because he was an assassin, because he was clearly associated with the communists. I no longer remember the details of what Mandela did before he was interned in prison, before he was brought to trial. He may indeed have been associated with communists. They have a history of getting around. There's no question about it. But of course, Mandela's orientation was against apartheid, against minority rule, pro-justice and pro-democracy. He may indeed have been involved with some bombings, but resistance does more often than not, take violent form. And look what he did when he came out of jail and became the leader of that very country which had previously incarcerated him. At one point she says here, Marilyn Nymark and Donna Neville, the authors of this Muzzle Watch article, while 750,000 New Yorkers of all sorts poured into the street to cheer this courageous hero, the Jewish establishment sat out the festivities. Anytime I see that figure, 750,000, makes me think automatically. That's the very same rough estimate or accounting of the number of Palestinian refugees who were generated in 1948. 750,000 Palestinians took flight and were forced out of their homelands. Okay, neat stuff. Let's go back to see what else is available. Today we have talked about some 50 kids, 50 children from the Balata refugee camp, the largest refugee camp in the West Bank, to visit the beach if they can raise the funds. Let me repeat the contact information for that endeavor. If you would like to help these 50 little Arab kids see the beach for the first time, about which they've grown up being aware of and never visited, email eir.nyc@gmail.com. For information, please put Balata Outing to Haifa, H-A-I-F-A. Balata is exactly as it sounds, B-A-L-A-T-A. Put Balata Outing to Haifa in the subject line for information on how and where to donate, eir.nyc@gmail.com. If you want to pay the bus company directly for the bus or the food directly by card, your credit or debit card, please indicate that and we can put you in touch with them directly. Asks Nancy, co-founder of Existence is Resistance. It's 5 minutes after 4, 1605 hours. On the Pacific Coast here in California, USA. Oh, what the heck. As long as we're talking about certain social aspects of Palestinians, take a listen to this. Here is a CNN report about the winner of Arab Idol, Mohammed Asaf. Here is a name you my contact person says, hi, here is a name you need to be familiar with when you enter the Arab-Palestinian world. Links will give you a direct experience of Mohammed Asaf's singing voice in Arabic. And you can just listen to the video, listen to the soundtrack of the video here. Whoops. You weren't listening to the video. You were listening to another show that was running. Here, let me do this again.
People from Gaza to the West Bank.
Okay, here's the soundtrack.
Palestinians haven't had a lot to celebrate
video.
Recently, but they do now. Mohammed Asaf won the Arab Idol singing competition Saturday. The 23-year-old Gazan impressed fans in his final act with a nationalist anthem, inspiring people from Gaza to the West Bank and beyond. CNN's Mohammed Jamjoon joins us now from CNN Beirut with more. It is an amazing story. This young unknown embraced first by his neighbors, his community, and now, it seems, by virtually the entire Arab world.
Well, that's right, Jonathan. You know, Arab Idol is the Middle Eastern version of American Idol. It is a sensation, and it's really become the feel-good story of the year. It's given this strife-ridden region a reason to smile. Mohammed Asaf's victory, you know, we were there last night. The crowd went absolutely wild, and his journey has been about so much more than just a singing competition.
He's given Arabs something to smile about. Palestinians, a reason to be proud. When Mohammed Asaf, a 23-year-old from Gaza, was crowned this year's Arab Idol, they went wild in the studio and celebrated in the streets.
Look, you see, everybody going crazy.
Everybody's happy.
Everybody's happy. This is the best thing to happen to Palestine since God knows when.
In Ramallah, an eruption of euphoria. They chanted his name, danced in his honor, set off fireworks. I'm very, very happy, says this young girl. I can't wait for him to come here. I'm so excited. I can't believe it. I can't believe it. An outpouring of emotion. In Gaza, it was gridlock. Mohammed's hometown came to a standstill while Palestinians partied. An extremely festive atmosphere for a population unaccustomed to happy endings. With an incredible voice and an inspirational story, it didn't take long for Mohammed to become a heartthrob and a hero. He made the difficult journey out of Gaza, but still barely made it to the tryouts in Cairo. Another contestant heard him sing and decided to give up his number so Mohammed could audition. Charming audiences and judges early on, he was nicknamed the Rocket and became a fan favorite, singing patriotic Palestinian songs. The former wedding singer told me he was overwhelmed and humbled, that he just lived the happiest moment of his life. An artist is made by his fans, he tells me. The love of your fans is better than all the money in the world. There's nothing better. And I feel like today, that's what I won. On stage after his big win, Mohammed was draped in a Palestinian flag, dedicating the victory to his people. He said he still couldn't believe his luck, but more than anything, he wants his success to challenge negative stereotypes, insisting Palestinians can overcome their dire economic and political circumstances. The Palestinian people can speak in a million languages full of beauty, love, and peace to the Arab world and to the whole world, he says. The Palestinian people don't love wars and killing and destruction. It's clear now the rocket has launched. Mohammed Asaf is soaring to stardom, hoping against hope that when Palestinians hear his voice, they'll finally feel they have a voice.
And Jonathan, just to underscore what an incredible story Mohammed Asaf has, when he got to Cairo, when he finally got out of Gaza and got to Cairo, not only was he late for the auditions, not only did he almost miss his chance, but in order to get into the hotel to audition, he had to scale a wall and he had to evade security to get in before he could start singing and have somebody give him his number so that he could try out. Jonathan?
It's amazing. I mean, it's such a story about one young man's achievement against all odds. And when you tell the story, we're reminded of it time and again. Couldn't get in, got there late, got help from another competitor who decided not to compete against him. You can see the impact in Gaza. You can see the impact in the Palestinian areas, but it's got to be resonating even more widely than that.
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons this show, Arab Idol, has become such a success. We just talked a minute ago about how there's so much strife in the region right now. Well, this show is all about music, not misery. And Arab viewers have really been cheering for the contestants. In a post-Arab Spring world, the three finalists were an Egyptian, a Syrian, and then Mohammed Asaf, a Palestinian who beat the odds. Now, I spoke with Lebanese superstar singer Nancy Ajram, who's also one of the judges of Arab Idol, asked her why the show was so special last night. Here's what she told me.
Arab Idol showed to the whole world that we in the Arab world have young, bright, and talented people, and we know how to dream big.
And again, Jonathan, we were there last night. The audience was ecstatic. You saw the scenes from Gaza to Mullah, and we've heard of so many other celebrations across the Arab world. Really just something to smile about here in this part of the world. Jonathan?
It's a really moving, moving story. Mohammed Jamjoon in Beirut, thanks very much.
No, I have not been coughing and heaving the whole time that you were listening to that. And when I thought I had my voice, it kind of backed up on me. One more little sidelight. As you were listening to the video from CNN, Cable News Network news report, there was a footer which noted that the Palestinian Authority, the closest thing that the Palestinians in the West Bank have to a government, the Palestinian Authority definitely was backing Mr. Asaf, the selected Arab Idol, Palestinian version of American Idol. So the PA-backed singer Mohammed Asaf has made a name for himself, and that's what that's about. Now, I want to, let's see. I have not had an opportunity to read the following, but the title of this piece alone makes me extremely curious. Behind the propaganda, what Israel is really up to. My source prefaced this entire link with this one short sentence. Former Israel Prime Minister Ariel Sharon tells all. Aha. Aha. Oh, well, it's okay, folks. Guess what? I have seen this before. It is a single quotation from Ariel Sharon. The sleeping man who lies still in a coma after he's been incapacitated for about a decade. His words live on. Here's the quotation. By Ariel Sharon in 1973. And as I recall, this was stated to Winston Churchill III, apparently in some kind of interview. And I quote, "We'll make a pastrami sandwich of them. We'll insert a strip of Jewish settlements in between the Palestinians, and then another strip of Jewish settlements right across the West Bank, so that in 25 years' time," he said this in 73, "so that in 25 years' time, neither the United Nations nor the United States, nobody, will be able to tear it apart." End quote. Admittedly, I was hoping that there would be a lot more details about what, as the title suggests, Israel is really up to. There are a number of comments that were made to this quotation as it appeared online. This person calls themselves the State of Palestine 1948. After 65 years of Israeli occupation on Palestine, they succeeded tearing Palestine apart, but we shall never give up. We shall resist till we gain Palestine back. Likes. This obviously, I'm looking at the Facebook page, which includes the quotation. Okay. This Facebook page is fb.com/campaign of exposing Israeli crimes via the social media. I should indeed look into that. FB.com, FB for Facebook, of course, /campaign of exposing Israeli crimes via social media. Irene Ferris, Jerry McGivern, Tosif Patel, and 44 others like this. Hajar Ibrahim says, rotten hell, I hope worms are making a pastrami sandwich of you, criminal. Claudia Chauffon, a local person here in my part of California, says, Hajar is so right. Hajar, evidently the editor of this particular quotation. And I don't think I'll read any more of these comments. There's a lot of anger and apparent hatred in some of them. Let's see if I can get back to the basic Facebook page. I know this. I've looked at it. Mention of Stephen Hawking's boycott of Israel, as he recognizes and does not approve of the Israeli government's dealings with and handling of the innocent Palestinian victims of occupation. Okay. Some other time for any of this stuff. And again, I do apologize for there not being more substance to this particular piece. 419 Free Radio Santa Cruz, Santa Cruz, California. This is the Mideast Madness Show. I'm Ren Tawil. Give me a call at area code 831-427-3772. Line 2 is 469-3119. Phone lines are open and waiting. I've just verified it. Now, I've mentioned Haaretz, which is the major newspaper of Israel. It is the oldest and, I would guess, the most famous publication, regular periodical out of Israel, Haaretz. The word Haaretz, incidentally, meaning in the Hebrew language, it means roughly the land, inferring the land of Israel, Haaretz. Now, with a name like that, and being the oldest paper, as successful as they are, you'd think that it would be a hotbed of right-wing, ultra-national, ultra-Zionist diatribes. Whereas, their reporting is remarkably candid about the bad things that happened in Israel and with the Israeli government, as well as the good things. And there are some real hothead leftists, I'm sure many Israelis would say, who write the opinion columns and editorials. Gideon Levy and Yuri Avneri among them. I don't know if they print so much of Yuri Avneri since he was effectively booted out of the country a few years ago for the publication of his book entitled The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. Avneri has become a refugee and now resides in Great Britain, whereas he once taught at the University of Tel Aviv. He is paying for telling the truth. So what the hell was I talking about here? Haaretz. You see, Haaretz has been bugging me to subscribe to their internet service. And in an enticement for me to do that, they sent a little something entitled Israel in Camera. Do you remember? Haaretz brings you 65 years of Israeli history from its photo archive. Click here for the slideshow. Kind of a funny title. Israel in Camera. I think it's kind of a weird, cumbersome title. But there is an interesting array of photographs in this collection. Now, the thing is, the reason why I bring this up, even though you can't see any of the pictures, is they bring to light a number of interesting events in the timeline of modern Israel history. And let's click upon this arrow. They're loading the timeline. See, there are comments associated with some of these pics that I want to get to. For example, Exodus filmed in Israel, the movie Exodus. The date is March 8, 1960. Exodus, which is the title of the second book of the Old Testament, as it is listed in the Christian Bible, which contains the Old Testament and the New Testament. The Old Testament being essentially the law of the ancient Hebrews. Exodus, filmed in Israel. During the film of the Zionist epic, they even use the term Zionist, they admit it. During the filming of the Zionist epic Exodus in 1960, the port of Haifa was transformed into a scene from a bygone era. In 76 days of filming in Israel and in Cyprus. Come on, computer. In 76 days of filming in Israel and in Cyprus, Hollywood's Otto Preminger dramatized the days of furtive immigration to mandate Palestine and the Jewish rebellion against British rule before the War of Independence. The Israel police cooperated, keeping curious onlookers off the set, which, the set, recreated the look and feel of the British Mandate days. Traffic was rerouted, modern signs were removed from view, contemporary residents were kept away, and in their stead, Arabs garbed in cloaks and keffiyehs or fezes were brought into Haifa specially and filled the cityscape. Whoops. Not one to cut corners, Preminger even obtained a real British tank from Cyprus. Even to this day, here in 2013, Cyprus has two big military bases, two bases on the island of Cyprus, an island they once owned. Which was still under British rule in 1960 and painted the words Palestine Police on it. Which would, of course, been British police, police of the British Mandate Authority. One of the key advisors on the project was Francis David Rome, the same British general charged with imposing a curfew on Haifa some dozen years prior, 1948. The world carefully crafted in Exodus helped engross American audiences and may have been key to boosting support for Israel. So that very last part has been forefront, is always forefront in my mind when I think of this movie and the production of the movie Exodus. They claim, Haaretz claims here, that Israel, as it was presented in the movie, commercial film Exodus, helped engross American audiences and may have been key to boosting support for Israel. Well, it's no secret to me. I've always felt that Exodus was a perfect example of major propaganda in the media, in the popular media. We all know how effective Hollywood is in shaping the general opinions of most Americans, who see films, just face it, they don't think about the real world that much. They go to escape briefly, temporarily escape the harshness of their own lives and to get away from discussion of politics and the evening news. And the movie Exodus was a perfect example of what was, among other things, I'm sure, an attempt to garner support for the Israeli dream of Zionism and to clear the land of all Arabs, of all non-Jews. Just as the movie Zorba the Greek may have been very instrumental in turning people on to Greek and therefore other forms of international folk dancing, I say this as an ardent international folk dancer who loves his Greek and Balkan dancing. Just as Zorba the Greek was instrumental in that manner, Exodus, as Haaretz admits here, did the same for Israel. What else do we have here? Let's look at Israel obtains all seven Dead Sea Scrolls. 1967 comes immediately to mind. The Six-Day War of June 1967. Are you going to show us or what? Oh, wait a minute. Oh, shoot. Well, if they show me the thing in the first place. Come on. This Israel obtains all seven Dead Sea Scrolls. Here we go. I'll read you the details here. February 13, 1955. 55. 12 years preceding the June War. On February 13, 1955, Moshe Sharet made a happy announcement. Israel has completed its collection of Dead Sea Scrolls, having acquired the last four of seven known to have survived the 2,000 years since they were written. The scrolls, written in Hebrew, Aramaic, Greek, and Nabataean, include the earliest manuscripts of the Bible ever found and over 900 other texts from the period. The Hebrew University had brought three from an antiquities dealer in Bethlehem. The remaining four were in the possession of Bishop Athanasius Yeshua Samuel, Metropolitan of Jerusalem for the Syrian Orthodox Church, who had acquired them from the Bedouin shepherds who had stumbled across them, Haaretz reported at the time. This was back in 55. The university negotiated with Mar Samuel, as the bishop was known. But the negotiations were cut off and the War of Independence erupted. That would have been 1948. Ultimately, the bishop did sell the four scrolls, not knowing that through an intermediary, they were being acquired by the Hebrew University. The scrolls are now housed at the Shrine of the Book on the campus of the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. Other scroll fragments are held in collections in the U.S. and Jordan. Okay, if I can trust all this information, then I have a slightly more complete picture. You'll recall a minute ago I was talking about 1967, the June War, springing to my mind. The very last thing they say in this piece, this other scroll fragments are held in collections in the United States and Jordan. Up until 67, Jordan held on to the West Bank of Palestine. It's Arab citizens determining by referendum that they will continue to be part of the nation of Jordan. Of course, the Israel, who were the victors of the 67 war, which they started militarily, sneak attack, succeeded in acquiring all the rest of the land of historic Palestine up to the Jordan River, therefore usurping the West Bank from Jordan and all but incorporating it into modern Israel. I was thinking of 67 because I had heard that the scrolls, if one of the indirect results of Israel's victory in 67 were that all the Dead Sea Scrolls came into Israel's hands, including these ones that were held by Jordan. So that's one thing that happened as a result of the war then, was they acquired all the Dead Sea Scrolls. Hence a war for supposed proofs of the legitimacy of the Jewish state, perhaps. Okay, it's really difficult to navigate my way through this stuff, so I'm going to just move along to something else. The big picture of Golda Meir here, Israel's first and only so far female prime minister during the 67 war, I might add. It's 4:34 in the afternoon. This is the July 1st, 2013 edition, Monday edition of Mideast Madness with Ren here. I'm Ren, R-E-N. Show normally officially goes until 4:55. Now, I think it's important that I rest for 5 minutes while you enjoy some Middle Eastern music. Thank you. Okay, my friends, fun's over. Back to the serious stuff now. I came across this article. It's actually a regular column in the... Come on. Are you monthly or what? I believe it's the monthly newsletter of the Santa Cruz Women's International League for Peace and Freedom group. For June, it looks like, yeah. Margaret Knight, this is her column, Shalom, Salam, Peace, Reports of the Middle East Cluster. Again, by Margaret Knight. I know her personally. Listen to this, folks. Brant Rosen is rabbi of a congregation in Evanston, Illinois, and co-chair of the Rabbinical Council of the Jewish Voice for Peace. He has written a remarkable book, Wrestling in the Daylight, A Rabbi's Path to Palestinian Solidarity. In an interview, Rabbi Rosen explained that his path began with the invasion of Lebanon in 1982 and culminated in the attack on Gaza in 2008. I knew in my heart, he said, that Israel's actions had nothing to do with security. This was oppression, pure and simple. His personal journey, he says, quote, raises questions about Israel's current path that go to the heart of the incendiary debate about Israel's future as a Jewish state. Whether it can change course and adopt values toward the Palestinians that reflect Jewish religious and cultural tradition, as well as whether a Jewish state can survive as a democracy without becoming a quasi-apartheid government, end quote. Rosen wrote openly about the ethnic cleansing that accompanied Israel's birth and was still continuing, the troubling undercurrents of a system that institutionally privileged one ethnic group over another. And, of course, he is talking about... the Jews being institutionally privileged in Israel over the native non-Jewish Palestinians, who are mostly Muslims, and many Christians. Back to tonight's article. The brutal crushing of Palestinian nonviolent resistance. He sees danger in, quote, fusing Judaism with nationalism. At the end of the day, how can you have a Jewish state that does not somehow treat non-Jews as, quote, other? That does not discriminate between Jews and non-Jews. That does not, on some level, create a system of institutional racism that privileges Jews over non-Jews. Rabbi Rosen goes on to say, so yes, I have personally come to the very painful realization that Jewish nationalism or I may or may not have read this wrong the way it's spelled here. So yes, I have personally come to the very painful realization that Jewish nation-statism nation-statism comes at a very real cost to our Jewish soul, compromising sacred values that teach us that all human beings are created in the image of God, that one law must be extended to all who live on the land, that we must love our neighbors as ourselves. Zionism, he emphasized, proclaims that Jews can only feel safe if they have their own Jewish state. But Rabbi Rosen points out that Jews survived centuries of persecution in Europe. Rosen says, "The secret of our survival over the centuries was precisely because we avoided the root of nation-statism and empire. Mighty nations have come and gone, and we're still here. Why? Because we Jews created a unique kind of model, namely a multicultural, multi-ethnic, spiritual peoplehood without borders. We have made," says Rabbi Rosen, "something of a Faustian bargain by embracing political nationalism so thoroughly. Indeed, Israel is one place today where Jews do not feel safe." This is from the June edition of the newsletter of the Santa Cruz WILF, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. Margaret Knight's regular column, Shalom, Shalom, Peace, reports of the Middle East cluster. Very last thing she says, "Indeed, Israel is one place today where Jews do not feel safe." One could easily take issue with that sentence because in the most recent few years, apparently there have been no Israeli deaths that were caused by terrorism, but that was only accomplished because of the extreme measures the Israeli military has taken in subduing Palestinians who don't even live in Israel, and in the creation of this what they call the security fence, and what many interpret as the apartheid fence, to literally keep apart, keep separate one from another. So even if there is a current reign of quote-unquote peace and security that the Israelis enjoy, they're doing so at the cost of political rights and justice for Palestinians, and still at the cost of many, many Palestinian lives. No parity there, folks. I don't think I want to read any more to people. I just want to see if we're still recording. Yeah, still recording the show. That's encouraging. Now, yeah, I've got a few things I need to make clear to people about this radio program and what I'm doing. This show has been on the air as it exists for Free Radio Santa Cruz, currently only on the World Wide Web, because we have no working antenna right now. As of last weekend, I helped take it down. Been doing this show for some 14 months now. I'm in the 14th month of Mideast Madness. I started in May of 2012, and I began every show for many months introducing myself as Ren or Lawrence Tawil, T-A-W-I-L, an Arabic name. Myself as a Palestinian Arab American whose father was born and raised in Jerusalem, born in 1915, when Palestine was still under the four-century-long control of the Turks, or as they called it then, the Ottoman Empire. So in 1915, the year of Dad's birth, the Palestinians were under the thumb of another colonial power. A neighbor, modern-day Turkey on the map, for those who are curious, to help you identify it a little more easily. Indeed, to be sure, a predominantly Islamic power, as earlier in this millennium, the ethnic domination of Islam by Arabic-speaking peoples transferred pretty much to the Ottomans, the Turkic peoples. And they carried the mantle of Islam for at least 400 or 500 years. But it was still an oppressive occupation. My grandfather, whom I never had the privilege of knowing personally, my father's father, my aunt told me the details about how he had his horror stories of life under the Turkish oppressor. The Turks came to his land several times and extorted from him money and property so that he personally would not have to serve in the Turkish army. They did this several times, an extended line of extortion, and my grandfather was desperate to keep coming up with stuff and wealth that he could give them, and after he gave them all that he could, the Turks still took him and indentured him into the Turkish army, where life was not pleasant for him, especially as an Arab. So the world is indeed a string of, in many cases, oppressive, highly discriminatory, and ethnically bigoted dominations of one people and over another. That's clear. That's history. We, in our classrooms, from grade school on up, have tended to whitewash a lot of that, ignore much of it, and certainly whitewash and ignore instances of the United States dominating the Native American Indians, dominating and stealing from the Mexicans in the far west of the continent, nearly two-thirds of their land. California, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, parts of other states was all won by Mexico from Spain in a conflict preceding the U.S.-Mexican War. We were taught to call it the Mexican-American War. It's more accurate to say the United States-Mexican War, putting the onus on the U.S., which really took its cue from the Texans, who chose to rebel from Mexico, even though they were invited by the Mexican government to come in and farm and ranch Texas. And we took that ball and ran with it. After Texas came California and all the land between there and the east of what is now the United States. We sent all kinds of troops into Texas and elsewhere. And then to seal the victory, the United States, how many of you even know this, actually militarily, physically invaded the country of Mexico, coming ashore from the Caribbean side, the east side of Mexico, at Veracruz, lovely city, I've been there. The Marines, a couple of thousand of them, I believe, landed at Veracruz, took that town, and were chasing Santa Anna into the interior, fought their way, and bullied their way into Mexico City, and then signed the quote-unquote peace deal, the capitulation deal of the then Mexican government at their, either the presidential palace or parliament, wherever the building was the seat of government in Mexico City. Yes, the U.S. invaded Mexico. So we did it to the Mexicans. We did it to the Native Americans. The Union Army tore Dixie to pieces in General Sherman's march to the sea as he divided the South all the way up to the Atlantic coast in Charleston, South Carolina. We beat the crap out of them and tore their infrastructure asunder, burned their towns like crazy. Sherman thought little of the negative consequences of that. He simply decided that we have to, as General William Tecumseh Sherman put it, they, the South, took it upon themselves to make war to begin with, referring to the attack on Fort Sumter in particular, and Sherman continued to say, we must make war so unpalatable, so nightmarish to them that it'll be generations before they consider taking that avenue again. Well, I suppose there's some wisdom in that, some military wisdom, but you can use anything to justify murderous rampaging and burning of towns, etc. Okay, well, I'm getting, obviously, I've gotten a bit off of the beaten track, but that's just to say something about the nature of empires and domineers. As a Palestinian American, obviously, I view Israel as a contemporary version of that very legacy, all under the guise of what they brag about being the only democracy in the Middle East. Israeli democracy does nothing for Palestinians under their thumb. This is the Mideast Madness Show. I'm Ren. I will talk at you again this Saturday, 11 in the morning, for the weekend version of Mideast Madness. That's not an exact title. Go to the free radio site at freakradio.org for our schedule, and you will be reminded of the time and time slot, Saturday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., for my next bout of talking to you. Thanks for listening. It's time for Palestine Today. Just hang on while I resurrect it. I was not able to download it before my show started because of the problems this computer is having. Let me shut this down now.